Merci, thank you for the coming. I'm sorry I can't speak French better. So this, I wanted to start with thanking my collaborators. I'm going to be showing a lot of recent science, published results. And so this involved a group at Michigan and at Georgia State and a few other universities that you see here. So you might wonder why I'm starting with this slide. This is one, I think, of the most beautiful slides in astronomy. This is from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's the ultra deep field. You know, this is what happens when you, you know, stare at one small part of the sky for a few weeks. You just see all that black space starts to fill in with light, seeing galaxies, you know, nearby galaxies as well as galaxies across the universe. And it always seemed a little unfair that, you know, with a relatively small telescope, you know, 100-inch, you know, 2.4-meter telescope, the Hubble, that's the kind of technology we've had on the ground for almost 100 years now. And yet, with this relatively small telescope, you can actually see these galaxies really at the edge of the universe. They're resolved. They're not point-like objects. Actually, you can see structure, you know, spiral arms, some evidence of how they formed. And what I study is stars, and in fact, to me, you look at this field, and in fact, indeed, there is actually something in here I would study here. This is a star. But you see, most of the sky does not have stars. It has these galaxies in the distance, in the background. And so this leads to sort of two radically different views of the universe, whether we live in a universe that's very crowded or rather empty. And so, you know, from the crowded perspective, we have galaxies. And to sort of quantify how crowded the universe is, you can just compare the size of a galaxy, you know, its natural size, to how many of that scale you'd have to go to find another galaxy. And so that ratio of size to distance to your nearest neighbor is some scaling of how crowded the universe is. So for galaxies, a typical Milky Way type galaxy, you'd have to go about 40 galactic radii till you find your neighbor. So like Andromeda, big neighbor, like Andromeda in our case. While stars, as you probably know, take up almost no volume at all in the universe, if you want to get to the nearest star from the sun, you'd have to go around 40 million stellar radii. Now, to put how empty this space is, you've all probably learned that, you know, matter, solid matter is mostly empty space, that in fact, you know, the nucleus, most of an atom is just empty space, and that you have a nucleus surrounded by an electron. But in fact, that's actually relatively crowded compared to the distances between stars. A nucleus, for instance, you can see you get to the next atom in solid material in around 100,000 nuclei distances, compared to 40 million. So indeed, the galaxy, in even a galaxy, is almost completely empty of solid or of condensed matter. So we can turn these ratios into angles, and this would tell you how big in the sky your nearest neighbor is. So if you're a galaxy, your nearest neighbor would be around 1 degree in size, which is indeed roughly the size of Andromeda. And if you're a star, you'd have to go down, instead of 1 degree, you'd have to go to 0.000001 degrees, or around what we call, in another unit, 5 milliarcseconds, or 1,000th of an arc second. So we'll just keep this number in mind for the next slide to see, well, is this possible with modern technology to do this? Well, you just heard some of resolution from I'm sure other lectures in this series. And so we can go to the basic diffraction equation, that the resolution of your telescope or interferometer is just very simply related to the wavelength that you're observing divided by the size of your telescope. That gives you the angle that you could resolve that's not going to be blurred out by diffraction, which we have no way to get around. And so if you think back to that previous slide, for a 5 milliarcsecond star, which is about as big as you can get for normal stars, that's our closest stars, are 5 milliarcseconds, you would need a telescope that is 40 million wavelengths across. So depending on your wavelength, that can either be the size of the Earth, or that could be the size of a valley in a mountain, depending on what wavelength of light. But the typical number you need is, you can see here, 40 million minimum to start being able to measure details on the surface of another star. So how are our major observatories stacking up against this? Well, the Hubble Space Telescope, which works in the visible, is around 2.4 meters, which is around 4.8 million wavelengths. So that resolution you see is about a factor of 10 too rough, too coarse to be able to image stars like the Sun, even our closest neighbors in the galaxy. The Keck Observatory, which is a larger telescope, but doesn't operate quite as short of wavelength, does a slightly better, around 6 million wavelengths, around 30 milliarc seconds. Now, to get a major observatory that has enough resolution, you'd go to the radio. The Very Long Baseline Array interferometer has telescopes that span the whole globe, so thousands of kilometers, and they operate in the radio, say 1 centimeter. And indeed, with this sort of system, you have great resolution. You see, you have nearly a billion wavelengths across this interferometer. Unfortunately, stars don't put out very much energy in the radio. They're way down the tail of the black body, and so even though this interferometer exists and has the resolution to observe the surfaces of stars, it doesn't have enough sensitivity to actually detect standard stars like the Sun. It would have to have a flare or some special magnetic activity to be able to produce enough radio emission that you could see it. So what we need, you can see, is we need an interferometer that is the size, that has, you know, 100 million wavelengths across, but we want it to be in the optical or the infrared. We can't do it in the radio. So what we need to do is take the VLBA, which is here, seen across the entire Earth, and what we want to do is now zoom. We want to change the wavelength to the visible. So that's about a factor of 10,000 in wavelength. And so to maintain the same resolution, this 100 million wavelengths across, we can zoom in a factor of 10,000. And this would maintain that diffraction limit. So if we just go powers of 10, 1 power of 10, 2, 3, 4 to 10,000, we're now zoomed in at the scale of one mountain on Mount Wilson outside Los Angeles. And here's are the telescopes that we're using at the Chara interferometer that you can see here has roughly the same resolution in terms of the number of wavelengths as the VLBA radio interferometer, but now can operate in the infrared and in the visible enough to do stars. So this is now an airplane view of it. You can see this is the famous 100-inch telescope, the 2.4 meter at Mount Wilson. Again, nearing its 100-year anniversary that Hubble used to discover the expanding universe. And hidden in the trees a bit, if you look, you can see the 1 meter, the relatively small 1 meter telescopes that comprise the Chara interferometer. So here you can kind of see the vacuum pipes that allow the light to be collected from these stations and be sent to this large building where the light is delayed and then ultimately interfered. So just a brief note of who built this system, because I didn't build this system. This was the Chara interferometer was built by PIs and mainly people at the Georgia State University. Hal McAllister was and is the PI. It was funded by the state of Georgia, National Science Foundation, and the Keck Foundation. But there have been other groups that have contributed expertise, in particular instrumentation, like cameras and combiners on the back to do science with it. And in addition to Michigan, there's actually both the Observatoire de Paris at Moudon and the Observatoire de Nice, which are current active partners that publish lots of papers and build instruments for this system. And that's really interesting because Chara is, in fact, has the largest resolution interferometer in the world. You might have heard talks about the VLT interferometer in Chile that ESO runs that people in Europe have a lot of access to. And that has a lot of great capabilities, in particular very large telescopes that go with it. But one of its deficiencies is it doesn't have as long a baseline because of the mountain that it's on has a limited size. And so Chara has sort of 2 to 3 times longer baselines and also operates at shorter wavelengths in the visible. So it can get many times more resolution than the VLTI, but it can't go as faint of objects because the telescopes are smaller, but for the brighter objects, it can observe them in finer detail. just for context, this started getting results in 2005. Antoine, do you have a laser pointer? My pointer just ran out of batteries. Oh, it's right here. Sorry, it's actually right here. Thank you. It's also low too. Battery. We need battery technology is what we need. Okay, so my main contribution to this whole affair has been working on instrumentation. And the combiner that we built at Michigan is called MIRC, Michigan Infrared Combiner. It was specialized to combine all the telescopes at the same time. Many interferometers only combine two or maybe three telescopes together, or maybe only have two or three telescopes that work together. But CHARA has six, which is the most of any, is equal or tied to the most of any interferometer. And so it has a unique capability of doing imaging. If you talk about imaging with interferometry, the main key is you have to have as many telescopes as possible to simulate the capabilities of a full telescope where you have, you know, where you have the complete telescope. So the way we do it is we take the light from each telescope, and we, after it gets delayed, we focus the light into a fiber, into a single mode fiber, fiber optics. And it, once it's inside this fiber, it can be transported and rearranged into a pattern. You can see here a particular pattern called a non-redundant pattern. And those little beams of light then come out and are focused together and form interference at this location. And then it can be put through a spectrograph, and we can dissect these interference fringes at different wavelengths and measure all the possible baselines in the array. So this is the V groove, the silicon V groove. These are the fibers that are holding the light right before the light comes out. Okay, so the first topic I guess I want to tell you about, which has turned out to be quite rich, is imaging some stars that are somewhat different than the sun. As you might guess, we know a lot about the sun because it's so nearby. We have lots of satellites and that orbit the sun and have looked at it. We can zoom in on the sun at a level that you could never do on another star. And so one of the most, of course, areas that you can gain the most is to go at stars that are different than the sun, because there we don't have very good measurements, and the theory of stars is going to be much more shaky once we start getting stars quite different than the sun. And one type of star that is, there are some stars out there, many stars out there, in fact, that are rotating, they're spinning extremely rapidly. I mean, so rapidly that they're actually bulging at the equator at the verge of almost breaking apart and flying apart. This is very different than the sun. I mean, the sun goes around every, you know, roughly 3 weeks or so. It takes about 3 weeks, depending on what part of the sun you're on, to go around. These kind of stars go around, say, in 12 hours. So these stars are bigger than the sun, and they go around, you know, twice a day. So they're extremely rapidly rotating. So this has been known for 100 years, ever since spectrographs had measured spectral lines and saw the Doppler broadening, the fact that one side of the star was coming at you at hundreds of kilometers per second, and the other side of the star is going away from you at hundreds of kilometers per second. This was very clear to see in even the very early spectrographs looking at stars. And in particular, von Zeipel made a series of papers in 1924 that made some basic predictions of what you might see if you could image these stars. One of them, as I mentioned already, is that it would cause the equator to bulge out, you know, just like the Earth and Jupiter and Saturn are all bulging at the equator a little bit, or even a lot for Jupiter. And Saturn, because of rotation, you'd expect these stars to be oblate, quite different than the sun, which is almost a perfect sphere, perfect circle almost. It would also, there's an effect that was hypothesized called gravity darkening that would happen. A simple way to think about that is that if the equator is going to be 20, 30% farther away than the pole from the center of the star where all the energy is coming out, it's going to be further down the temperature curve, the temperature gradient, and so it will be a colder temperature. And so he had a theory on how much colder the equator might be compared to the pole, and he gave this term gravity darkening, because it turns out because it has to do with that the gravity is lower at the equator, effectively lower at the equator because of centrifugal forces. And lastly, and this is a really open question, we don't really know what happens to stars that are spinning so fast, and then they start aging and evolving as they burn hydrogen into helium and they start changing their luminosity and temperatures. We don't really know what happens to the angular momentum distribution. You might think originally they're all the whole star is spinning together like a solid body, you know, just like a billiard ball all together spinning. But what would happen when the core starts to contract as it fuses, it would start to spin up faster, just like an ice skater, you know, pulling in. Its angular momentum is conserved, and as it contracts, it might spin up faster. And the outer layers of the star, which end up moving away as the star gets brighter and more luminous, might slow down. And so there's a you know, torques inside the star that we don't know fully how they resolve themselves. I mean, just as lesson in modesty, you know, even today we are discovering, you know, new things about how the sun's angular momentum is distributed. A lot of the things that we thought we knew was proven wrong when we were able to use helioseismology to measure what's going on inside the sun. We found our theories were quite wrong. So we have to be modest that our theories of what happens inside stars, I mean, if we were wrong about the sun even 10 years ago, you can imagine how wrong and misguided some of our theories about totally other, you know, very different stars than the sun might be today. Even though we use it in our computer codes, we use it to predict supernovae and exploding stars and lots of areas, we have to make assumptions about what happens inside stars when they age. And so we think that if we can understand this better, we can start to test our models against these various areas of astronomy. One of the interesting areas I'll talk about in this talk is one of the things we use is a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram to figure out the ages and masses of stars. This is where we use models of stars, and then we look at a star and we say, okay, the star is this temperature and it's this bright, luminous, and so we can, from computer models, we can say, okay, so it must be, you know, 3 solar masses and it's 500 million years old. We can age and date them so we can learn about stars. But as you'll see, by not taking into account rotation, you can be quite wrong about these issues. Okay, so a little history here. So rapid rotation has, as I mentioned, was been seen for a long time in spectrum, that a spectral line on the star will be broadened because, again, part of the star is moving towards you, part of it is moving away from you. Now, some even stars that don't seem to be rapidly rotating can actually show some funny effects. So while many hot stars, when I say hot stars, I mean basically stars hotter than the sun, stars around, say, 8,000 Kelvin or hotter, 9,000, 10,000 Kelvin compared to the sun, you know, which is around 6,000. A good fraction, about half, show lines that are, you know, 100 kilometers per second or broader. So that's some arbitrary definition of a rapid rotator. Now Vega, everyone knows Vega. Vega is the famous star Vega, Alpha Leary, which is a standard star in many respects. It was the basis of the whole magnitude system in astronomy. I mean, Vega is defined to have a magnitude of 0 at every wavelength, so it's a reference for visual observers who want to tell you how bright another star is. They compare it to Vega. So Vega is a very famous star in astronomy. And when they measured its spectrum, they actually found that it had very narrow lines, which would say it's not a fast rotating star. It could just be a slowly rotating hot star. Now, it turns out that people looked at this in more detail, and a star that's not rotating very fast should have a profile that looks parabolic, this red line. You see how it has this parabolic shape. But Vega's spectral lines looked a lot more what they call flat bottom. They went down and then kind of leveled off and was pretty flat and went up. And this was sort of a mystery why this would be, but one idea that could resolve this is if Vega was rapidly rotating, but it was oriented so that the pole of the star was almost pointed right at us. So the motion is moving around in the plane of the sky, so we don't see this Doppler effect. So the lines look narrow, so you might think the star is sitting, not rotating, but in fact it's just a projection. And this effect could come from this gravity darkening effect I mentioned. If the equator is actually quite dark because of this gravity darkening, it would change the shape of this profile. So this was an hypothesis, I thought quite a bold hypothesis in the 80s and 90s, that Vega, this classic star, that we maybe have been misinterpreting it for, you know, the last 100 years. Now, first, before Vega was observed to for sure, the first star that was observed to be a rapid rotator with interferometry, actually seeing that it was not a circle, a circular star, the first time a star, a normal type star, was seen not to be a circle, was Altair. So another, you know, great star in the summer triangle. Altair is a well-known rapid rotator. It is rotating at many hundreds of kilometers per second based on its Doppler shifts. So we know this one's a rapid rotator. And the Palomar testbed interferometer measured, like I said, actually measured in this case, that in one dimension, the star was 14% longer than in the other dimension. Now, with these very simple early measurements, they couldn't make an image. They would just basically measure a size along one direction, and they'd measure it along another, and then you would just use tomography to try to fit a model to that idea to try to understand it. So this is, you see this model of a grid. You see this sort of grid radicule model there that fitted the sizes that were measured. But soon after this, they did the same thing with Vega, and they found that with two different groups using different wavelengths, different interferometers, they found the exact same result, which was that Vega is very circular, so it is not, in that sense, it doesn't look like a rapid rotator, but the edges of the star are extremely dark, much darker than you'd expect from a star that's not rotating quickly, but very consistent with this gravity darkening effect. And so with using, again, two different groups, two different methods, everything, they got very similar results that Vega was actually rotating at 91% of breakup, but its axis just happens to be pointed at us to within about 5 degrees. So it's almost exactly pointing at us, only five degrees away from pointing straight at us. And so this confirmed these hints and clues that that other spectroscopists had been saying for 20 years. But now we have real direct evidence that this star is not a normal, slowly rotating star. So where I come in here in the mid-2000s is then trying to go further. So to interpret this beyond, you have to use models, of course, because you're only measuring a limited amount of information. And so the idea is we wanted to just try to make an image so we didn't have to make as many assumptions about what we were seeing. And this is important because a lot of the theory behind these stars is relatively, you know, poorly understood. It's literally true that people are still using models from 1924, which gives you a feeling for how little progress and how poorly tested this is. I mean, I'm sure this guy was quite smart, but there's not very much theory from 1924 in stellar astronomy that, you know, is still valid. And the reason, and as you'll see, we're showing that a lot of this stuff isn't so valid anymore, but it just has never been able to be tested until now. Just, again, almost 90 years later, we're finally able to test predictions made in the early part of the century, last century. With modern computers, there have been other researchers, there's a really important group in Toulouse, Espinosa-Laurent Retard, which has been doing really nice work where you just try to solve the physics problem. You know, just put a bunch of hydrogen gas and you spin it and you ask, what does that ball of hydrogen gas do? You know, you put some energy in the center, which is the core, you spin it up, you try to put in viscosity, hydrodynamics. You know, you'd think that with modern supercomputers, we'd be able to just, you know, put that in the computer and wait a few weeks and we would know the answer. But in fact, we still can't simulate that without bringing assumptions about, again, angular momentum and how the angular momentum is going to be distributed and what are the sources of hydrodynamic viscosity. These things which you might think would be known by now are not known, and we cannot predict this. In fact, just by changing a little bit the assumptions, you can make predictions that the star will be rotating more quickly at the equator than the poles. This would be like in the sun, where you have what's called differential rotation, that, you know, part of the sun goes around faster than other parts of the sun. So some models would predict that these hot stars like Vega should be have differential rotation, and others say they shouldn't or should have it in the opposite way. So clearly the physics is not well understood, and so, of course, observations are a great way to help push the modelers in the correct direction. Okay, so what I'm going to show you is the images that we try to do, and we try to loosen the assumptions on the models. Okay, so our first image of this actually is the first image of a main sequence star besides the sun that we did. There had been some really interesting images made of red giants. So if you know much about red giants, these are hundreds of times larger than normal stars. And so there are a few of those that you could actually even do You know, you could even do that on the 100-inch telescope. In fact, you know, could measure the sizes of Betelgeuse, for instance, was measured in the 20s. It's so large compared to every other star. But in terms of a star that you could say is sort of like the sun, a main sequence, hydrogen-burning star, this is the first time. So this Altair, as I said, is very nearby and very rotating quickly. So this is our image that we got. Here's the radius of the sun down here in this bar. And what you see is a couple features. You see that it's elongated in one direction compared to another. This we already knew, remember, from those previous measurements. It had already been measured to be elongated. But what we now add to it is we see this strong temperature change that in the direction orthogonal to the elongation, which we would say is the polar direction, this would be the equator direction and the polar direction, we see that indeed the temperature is hotter at one end, which would be the pole, and it gets colder near the equator, which is this gravity darkening effect that was predicted. So on the surface, this looks quite a good triumph of von Zeipel's theory from 1924. Here's a simulation of what the theory might be as a model for this image. So this is the image that we actually saw, and this would be the model image that theory would predict. So there's a pretty good agreement between this, at least qualitatively. So let me show you a nice animation of this. So what you're seeing are two effects. I just want to point out, there's another effect that is called limb darkening that the sun has. Every star has limb darkening. That is, when you're seeing the edges of a star, you're not able to penetrate as deeply into the star, and so it looks cooler or fainter at the edges. And so this is the way a star looks when it's not rotating or rotating very slowly. You see that it's bright in the middle, and then it starts to get a faint at the edge, the limb. Now, as you spin it up, what you'll see is not much happens for a while, but when you get up to a certain kind of critical amount, you see that it starts to bulge at the equator, and then at the end you start to really get this strong darkening at the equator due to gravity darkening. So this is our model, animated model of Altair. Going around, you see almost once every 8 hours or 9 hours or so in this model, and this is the image. So I think this is quite nice. Now, to go further than just looking at pretty pictures, we want to do some science, some physics. We want to compare it to some predictions. So this is where we get into gravity darkening. The temperature on the surface is supposed to go like the gravity at the surface compared to this some coefficient beta. And theory had suggested two values for this. For hot stars like these, you'd expect a 0.25 for this value, and for the cooler stars, a lower number, 0.08. And so this is a really easy to test thing. What do we measure? If we take our image and we try to fit it with this model of a temperature versus gravity, what do you get? So what we get is somewhere in between. So we get beta 0.19, and that has an error of only about 0.01 or 0.02. So it's quite inconsistent with either of those values. So that's already interesting. And you know, in the first paper, we came up with some possibilities. What might be the reason for this? One thing that's kind of fascinating in this star, Altair, is that the equator is more than 1,000 Kelvin cooler than the pole. So that's a huge amount. I mean, that is the difference between an A star and an F star. I mean, this is not a subtle thing. This is a huge change in the conditions on the surface. And in fact, when you get down below around 7,000 Kelvin or so at the equator, other stars that are that cold are convectively unstable, and the total nature of the energy transport changes. And so this actually shows that you can have these funny stars where the top and the bottom, the poles, are hot, and the energy is being transported radiatively, that is carried through the photons, through the energy field of the photons. But then the equator could be cool enough that, in fact, the energy is transported convectively by the motions. It's convectively unstable. And no one's ever made a model inside of a computer to try to figure out what would happen, you know, what happens in a star that has those two different regimes simultaneously. Just as an example of where, you know, we try to push the boundaries here. So that's one issue. Maybe the fact that the equator is so cold and that it could be convectively unstable is just making this model inconsistent, and so having something in between these two extremes might be a reasonable thing that could happen. Other problems are with the assumptions. I mentioned differential rotation. These models assume there is no differential rotation, so that could change this interpretation. There could be flows of energy, meridional flows, you know, basically where energy at the hotter regions will want to flow towards the colder regions, right? That's what happens on the Earth. That's what happens on the planets, right? You have wind, thermal winds that basically blow from the equator out to the poles, and then it flows back. That will change the temperatures if that is operating. That's ignored in the von Zeipel theory. And then there are other ones that are more subtle. So to answer those and try to get at that, we need to look at more objects, not just one, right? Because those different explanations will have different effects as you go to the hotter or you go to the colder stars. So here's a number of objects we can do. So we started with Altair, which is kind of a middle-of-the-road A star. We followed that up in 2009 with two more objects, Alderaman and Rosselhaag. This is actually my favorite image of a star, because you can actually see it's at just the right angle that you can see on the far limb it's starting to get brighter again. So you can actually see the equator totally traced down in this dark band. And then we keep going, and last year we went to even more extreme cases of Regulus, which is quite a hot star. It's a B star, in fact, and Beta Cass, which is technically an F star. So we went from the A stars to even just outside the extremes to the B and the F stars. So what did we learn by doing that? Well, for each of these stars, we can now measure this beta parameter, right? Remember, beta is this parameter that's supposed to be 0.25 for the hot ones and 0.08 for the low ones, cool ones. So let's see what we got. So this is a plot of the temperature. It's actually a plot of the temperature range from the equator to the pole. So that's why it has a large range here, because as I mentioned, there's 1,000 to 2,000 Kelvin difference between the extremes. And then the up and down is this beta parameter, and the box is the error, is roughly the error that we have in the measurement. And so as I mentioned, here's Altair sitting here. It's about 0.19. But you can see now the other objects we measured also have numbers that don't agree with the 0.25, which is up here, which then turns into a low value at the low temperatures. Now these, you could say, are kind of on this line, and so maybe you could think that there's some effect happening because of this, again, that the equator could be convective while the pole is not. But Regulus is so hot that it should be not, there should definitely be no convection in the surface layers of Regulus, and it is also at the same level. So we made the claim that we think this is now sufficient evidence that the von Zeipel prediction of 0.25 is not bearing out for the hot stars that are really close to like 90%, these really fast rotating stars. And so we don't know the reasons why, but just from an observational fact, you know, we recommend now other astronomers who need to model these stars, they should be using this other value just because it has, you know, because it's now measured. Now, why is not clear, but just after our paper came out, just a few months ago, there was a result that tried to explain this lower value of beta. Here's beta again. This was by the group at Toulouse, and they made a slight change to the von Zeipel theory where they took into account that the energy is not flowing radially, but when it's elongated, it flows along the potentials of the shape, basically, of equipotential surfaces in the rotating star. So when they took this into account, they came up with an interesting result, that when the star is rotating slowly, relatively slowly, which is in this graph near zero, you get the value from von Zeipel, because when it's not rotating quickly, then it's more or less a spherical star, and so you get the same result he got, which is 0.25. But as you spin up the star and you become more and more elongated at the equator, this beta parameter would go down. And they showed that, and here's our data that we took, these boxes drawn on a different axis here, but you see that this 0.19 is consistent with at least three of the four of these objects. So this is an interesting possible explanation for our measurements, maybe. So that's quite a fast turnaround when you have an observation and you have a new theory paper within 6 months explaining it. So the other thing we can do is now, because we're measuring not just the amount of gravity darkening, which I said, but we're now measuring the three-dimensional orientation of the object. So normally when you see a star in the sky, you have no idea of this inclination, right? You can measure its broadening, but you don't know its sign. It's called the sine I, the, degeneracy. You don't know if it's pointed at you or almost perpendicular to you. But now with our models, we actually know that quite precisely what the inclination is. And we even have the model or the measurements of the temperature across the whole surface. So what we can do is actually know the real temperature and luminosities, the average temperatures and the average luminosities of these stars. It may not be that obvious, but when you have a star like these, if you're looking at it at the pole, where you see the hot pole, and you see it elongated, you would think that this star is twice as luminous as it actually is, because you're seeing the brightest half of it. Because when you look at the equator, you're seeing the cool part, and you're seeing it being squashed, you know, not as big. And so the same star, if you're looking at it from two different directions in the galaxy, you would think it's a factor of two different in its true brightness, true luminosity, and you would measure a totally different temperature as well. And so clearly this has to be corrected, and now because we have our models, we can correct it. So this is the HR diagram. This is luminosity of the star, and this is the temperature of the star. And this is what astronomers make to measure the masses. These are the mass. This is a young star would be over here along this beginning line. And as they age, say a two solar mass star would go along this line. The luminosity would go up, the temperature would go down, and then at this point it goes to become a giant, goes into the helium burning phase over here at the edge. So this is an example of one of our stars, Beta Cassis. Beta Cassis turns out to be one of those objects that you see almost face on. So it actually looks like it's right here. See this star up here? This is where you would put Beta Cassis. If you didn't know anything else except what you measure at the telescope, a single telescope, Beta Cassis would be up here. It, in fact, would be outside of the main sequence. It would not even be in a part of the diagram it's allowed to be in, if you notice that. It's to the right of even these lines. Now, we can correct for the rotations, and et cetera, and so we can actually move it back down to this point here, which is its true total luminosity, taking into account all the different viewing angles. But you notice this is also outside the line, or right at the edge of the line. So there's one last thing we have to correct, and that is the fact that when you spin a star up, if you imagine a star not spinning at all, it's sitting there at some temperature and luminosity. When you spin it up, like these stars are, it gets bigger, which and the equators get colder, and so it appears colder than it would be if it weren't rotating, right, because of this gravity darkening effect. And all of these grids are for stars that aren't rotating. They don't take into account rotation. So what we have to do is we have to basically pretend this star is not spinning anymore. We have to take the star with its properties, and we have to basically mentally spin it back down to what its temperature would be so that we can use these models. And when we do that, it moves it over to a higher temperature, and then indeed now it sits at least in a feasible part of the diagram, and we can estimate its mass and its age this way. Now this, of course, is worrisome. We have to do all this mechanics to try to fix its mass and age, and so it'd be nice if we could have a way to really measure its mass and age, right, to check. This is, of course, really the main point of doing this work, is we actually want to test theories of stars and see if our theories are correct. Now, normally, you can only measure the mass of a star if it has a companion that is going around it. And you can measure its orbit and its period and its separation and then use Kepler's laws and Newton to figure out the mass of the two stars. And that's the only real way that you can do it for normal stars. But it dawned on us in this work that we have a new way to measure the mass of a star, a single star, which is kind of a holy grail. If you can measure a mass of a single star without another thing around it, that really is great, because it's almost impossible. So what we realized is that when you measure this oblateness, you know, this how much it's elongated at the equator, there's some ratio of how elongated it is. That's just a number. That's a dimensionless number, right? It's 1.2, you know, some number, equator divided by the pole. That number is a ratio between the gravity force and the centrifugal force at the equator. That's what that is telling you. It's a ratio of how important gravity is compared to centrifugal force. And so we measure that oblateness, so we measure the ratio of gravity to centrifugal force. And because we have the model, we know its radius because we resolve it with the interferometer. These stars are nearby, so we know the distance from parallax. And we know the velocity because we have the V sine I from the Doppler effect. And so we actually know the actual speed at the equator, We know the radius at the equator. So that means we know the centrifugal force at the equator. And so we can then solve for the gravity force. And so that gives us the mass. So right now, this method is in its infancy. We're just starting to apply this method to stars. But so far, so good. This was the mass we got of that star from the previous diagram, around 1.89 solar masses. And this was the mass we get using this new approach of using all the data along with these three-dimensional model to estimate the gravity over centrifugal force. And we get 1.82 plus or minus 0.1. So they definitely agree with each other within error bars, but obviously we want to reduce the errors more so that we can constrain the fit even better, or constrain the test even better. Okay, so I'm just going to move. The last part of my talk is, I'm actually done talking about rapid rotators. But I wanted to show two special topics before I go of other imaging that we've done. One of the things that we can do with CHARA for the first time ever, also in addition to measuring a main sequence star for the first time, another neat thing we can do is measure what are called interacting binaries for the first time. So Beta Lyrae is another very famous star if you're an amateur astronomer, because it's bright and it's an eclipsing system that eclipses every about 2 weeks. Here's what the light curve does. They have this big eclipse, and then it goes back up, and then there's a little eclipse. And these are the two stars, you know, alternately blocking each other. So the orbit is almost exactly on the edge. And the system is a strange system, because when stars get that close together, they start interacting with each other and exchanging mass, and all sorts of interesting things happen. And so in this system, it's kind of hard to see here, but One of the stars is filling what's called its Roche lobe. It's grown to as big as it can get, because beyond this size, it is losing mass at this location, and it's falling onto the other star. And that star is actually covered in a disk of material that has surrounded it. And so this is a very complicated system. Here's an image before interferometry. People were drawing images. So this is what it's thought to look like with the imagination of the artist. You have the first star filling its Roche potential, Roche lobe, and it's putting material onto the neighbor. So we can now, for the first time, resolve this action with the interferometer. So this is 1 milliarcsecond. This is our image. You see that this star is, as predicted, elongated in this direction, just like you get in those previous images. When a star is filling its Roche lobe, it starts to look like an egg shape rather than a circle. And so we actually are seeing this egg shape. And here is here's the star that you can, it's not actually the star, it's the disk surrounding the other star that we're seeing. And because this changes every 2 weeks, we can make a movie of this. So another side effect of measuring things at the level of milliarcseconds is nothing ever stays put. Everything's moving around. So, you know, it will change on the periods of days or weeks or months. And so this one is changing, of course, very quickly. So here's our movie of this interacting binary system. And sometimes you can kind of get this feeling that the fainter one is kind of has this stuff around it. Like it's kind of at the edge of believability. It's right at the edge of detection. But you can kind of see there's kind of this fluffy stuff kind of sometimes you can kind of see in these images around the fainter component. And that's this disk of gas that is hiding the main star, which is, in fact, the more massive star is the one you can't see. It's the one that's hidden. And as you can also see, of course, it's edge-on, as we know, because it's an eclipsing system. So this one, indeed, is going along an edge-on orbit. We also can now do this for another one, Algol. Algol, everyone knows Algol. Algol is another famous, you know, from antiquity, based on it. You know its name. It's a bright star if it has a name like Algol. And it also is eclipsing. It kind of blinks every 4 days. It's a very short period. Every 4 days, it kind of blinks as a partial eclipse. And it's also nearly edge-on, or it wouldn't do that. And here's our orbit. You see the full orbit is only a few milliarcseconds across. And here's our movie showing that. And you can see it goes through a secondary eclipse there and comes back around. And you can see here it blocks the central one at that point, most of it, and then comes back around. So these are some recent papers analyzing the systems with new detail. Okay, so I'm going to end today with a really unique case. This is a unique, I guess, is almost too weak of a word for this one. This is a really spectacular object called Epsilon Auriga. So has anyone followed? Anyone in the audience happen to know anything about Epsilon Auriga? Any amateur astronomers here. Well, Epsilon Auriga is famous. For more than 200 years, it's been known that something weird happens at Epsilon Auriga. It has an eclipse, like those other stars, but what's weird about this eclipse is the eclipse lasts for about 2 years. And that's really strange. And at first they didn't know it repeated itself. 200 years ago it was seen that it got dimmer and it was weird. And then about 80 years later someone noticed it again. And then it turns out it repeats itself every 27 years. So you have this very long eclipse that lasts more than a year. It's about a half. It's not a 100% eclipse, but 50% of the light goes away for about 27 years, or for a few years, and then it repeats every 27 years. And it's really hard to understand what it is because there's no evidence of a second star, and yet with this 27-year repeating period, there's almost surely another star in there. And so to make sense of everything, it led to this idea that there's this star. The bright star here is Epsilon Auriga, and there's a dark star, or it could even be a black hole or something, that is surrounded by a disk. And so the reason why this eclipse lasts for 2 years is because you have this large disk of material that is causing the eclipse. This is not a two stars eclipsing each other, which would only last a few hours or so. This is a star being eclipsed by this huge disk, and the mystery is, what is this disk? We don't see the star. What is this disk made of? Why is it there? What is it going around? All these details are swirling because we have no idea. It's just such a mystery and weird case. Now, every 27 years is interesting because for the last 200 years, every 27 years you have big advances in technology. And indeed, if you look at the literature in astronomy, every 27 years, astronomers go crazy looking at Epsilon Auriga to try to figure out what it is, and there's always a lot of new technology after 27 years. First it was just optical, then it was different then it was film, then it was spectroscopy, then you could get polarization, you could get infrared. Just every 27 years is a really neat number to see big changes in techniques and new advances, new telescopes, radio, all sorts of things develop in 30 years. So this is the year for interferometry. This is one of the techniques that developed in the last 30 years that is making a big difference in this particular system. So this is just showing you these eclipses. They go down, they kind of wiggle around maybe, they come back up. The star itself is fluctuating, and so some of these wiggles you see like this might be the star itself getting brighter, or maybe it's something to do with the eclipse. It's not clear. We put all the data together, and this model came out of how to explain it. It's hard to create this. It's a very unlikely scenario, but it seems to explain the data. You have a very, very thin disk, edge on. It's blocking its star that it's surrounding, so that's why we can't see its star. And it's moving by and eclipsing Epsilon Auriga in such a way that it blocks about half of the star. And it moves across. So this was the schematic 1980 before Photoshop, what you could do. So we were really excited to observe it. This time came around in 2009. The amateurs of the world amateur astronomers are watching it, sitting there, and indeed, pretty much when expected, you start to see the light going down, meaning the eclipse is starting. We want to go observe it. Well, what happens? We're ready. We have it all planned to observe this star, and what happens was huge forest fire on Mount Wilson here. This actually, the mountain literally almost burned down. Every place around it got completely burned down. It was at one point all the firefighters, as you can see here, had abandoned the mountain, and the wind was going to destroy the observatory, but by some, again, luck, the wind changed, and the firefighters were able to come back and do what they do. You see water dropping airplanes here flying above one of the charred telescopes, and they managed to save it, but it did delay us, but luckily not too bad. And so indeed, we got a number of observations. These arrows show where we observed it with the interferometer, and so we got on it right after the fire. Is one of the first things we tried to do. So here's an image of what it looked like before the eclipse. We had an image from the year before showing nothing too weird happening. This is a circle drawn around the star. And so the first epoch of data, this is our image that we have. It looks remarkably like this drawing, if you ask me. You see this little, it's like the finger of God, stop putting his finger in front of Epsilon Auriga. And you look a month later, and it seems to have been moving, getting bigger. And indeed, in January or February, we have, I think, a once-in-a-lifetime situation where here's a star that's almost an exact semicircle shape rather than being a circle. So I would never have thought we'd ever make an image of a star that was the shape of a semicircle. And this, of course, explains the data, right? This is why it's a 50% eclipse. Indeed, just as Camp had predicted, that you have this very thin, dark band that's just blocking half the star. So let me just say we've done this a few more times. Unfortunately, we couldn't catch it coming out of eclipse because of the sun, you know, the stupid sun during the day. We couldn't observe it. But we can only observe the star half the year. But we were able to make an image. And Brian Kloppenberg, who led this work, who's at University of Denver, did a really cool thing where what he did is rather than making a movie showing the progression in time, what he did was he made a model of the disk where he's, instead of making the star, have the disk move in front of the star, you try to keep the disk fixed and you move the star behind the disk so that it's almost like it's making a shadow, like an illumination. And so if you change the way you drew these drawings, this is actually an image of the disk. You see the star being moved across and you can see this very thin disk that it reveals from our data. Okay, so that's really my last slide. Let me just end with saying that, you know, I grew up, and even still textbooks that I use in my own classes say that, you know, we will never image stars beside the sun. They are so infinitely far away that no telescope will ever make an image of another star. And they still say that. You probably have textbooks here that still say this. But I hope I've shown you that that's no longer true, that with CHARA and with VLTI, with interferometry, we can now image stars, we can image interacting binaries. And the next thing we're going to image, which actually you're going to hear about next week, believe it or not, is imaging planet-forming regions around young stars. And I know that's your talk of Miriam Benesty next week. She's going to be talking about with the VLTI's effort to apply these methods to image the inner parts of disks around young stars where we think planets are forming. So thank you very much.